The theme for this evening's talk is the power of trust, the power for change. I was reading a book recently, and this book endeavored to examine contemporary issues, political, social, economic, etc. And one of the economists in this book described the kind of culture that we are living in at present, and using rather strong language, as a culture which is engaged in an orgy of creation and destruction. An orgy of creation and destruction. And the reference to this in our daily life is how much, as human beings, as men and women on this earth, we seem to have become prisoners and hardly realizing it. Prisoners to our debts, prisoners to what's going on around us, prisoners to all these so-called choices that you and I are faced with day in and day out. And it's like the world and the culture and the environment in which we live, instead of deeply nourishing us as human beings, seems to in fact be having rather the opposite. And that we, instead of feeling satisfied, seem to feel increasingly more dissatisfied. And the impact of that happens day by day in our life. Just recently in Britain, we had the general elections, and our Conservative Member of Parliament, who was standing for re-election, and somewhat nervously, since he only had a rather small majority of 800 votes out of an electorate of 80,000 people. And I went to a political meeting that he gave, and there were around 20 of us at it. 10 years ago or more, the town hall would be filled with 400 or 500 people, and I know only too well, having stood twice for Parliament for the Green Party and have been involved. And there are about 20 of us there, and I commented to him that out of the 20, there were only 2 who weren't in the grey hairs, or what we call the blue rinse ladies. And the 2 who weren't, one was his daughter and the other was his secretary. And I said to him, why is there this apathy, this disinterest, you know, are people overworked? Is it that people just get home and just arrive home and just flop in front of the television? What do you see as the reason that we've gone from a town hall full of people, standing room only, down to 20? We couldn't even fill the front 2 rows. And he made a rather telling and somewhat insightful comment, particularly being a Conservative Member of Parliament. I'm not used to insights from them. And sorry about that, apologies for those of you who are Conservatives. He said, in his campaign and meeting with people and knocking on the door, he said, people have become frightened of the world. There is a withdrawal from the world. And all that people want to deal with is their home lives, their personal life, if they're married with children, their family lives, and perhaps one or two friends, and one or two close family members. And people don't want to step outside of that world. It's become fearful. It's become a problem. And so human consciousness finds itself tragically and sadly shrinking into a smaller and smaller self-enclosed unit and is unable to see beyond them. And in listening to him, I, and of course others agreed wholeheartedly. And I think we have to take a look and see, is that in some way some loss for us, and a very deep and rather personal loss, of some loss of trust, some loss of confidence in being able to change circumstances and conditions inwardly and outwardly, as we kind of become slaves to the current fetish: money, prestige, status, goals, achievement, success. And that instead of that informing us and enlightening us, we have actually become so involved in it, we think that's all that matters, and our world has closed and closed. And of course, with it the loss of passion for life, with it the loss of trust and the loss of confidence. And I think it's going to be a rather brave and courageous human beings, in a rather fresh way, who are genuinely willing to question all of that, genuinely willing to find ways to break free from it. Because I think it's an enslavement to desire, enslavement to self, enslavement to particulars, which is just as severe and just as sad as any kind of enslavement that we've known. And we've become slaves to material worlds, slaves to consumerism, slaves to the corporate projections upon us, slaves to the propaganda that our governments give out to us, and we repeat so blindly and foolishly, totally forgetting that the source have been something that we've read in the media, and we're just repeating it because we've become a robot. And it's no easy thing to say, I need to find out for myself, I need to make changes. And for some, those changes will have to be a real breakthrough. And the Buddha compared that to a chicken living in a shell. And there's a certain odd sort of comfort in that shell. And the mother hen is sitting on top, etc. But somewhere the time, and some of our mothers are still sitting on top of us, and please note, and sometimes we have to look and see what's going to crack the shell, what is going to be the force that frees us, and we break out. And I think that's almost a new kind of journey in life, and a new expression of spirituality. And that's going to be a break with many, many things. And some, and rather too few, but some are willing to do that, are willing to take this good, hard, honest look at one's life, and see that these kind of Dharma teachings really is to help evolve a new kind of human being with a new kind of consciousness, a new kind of vision, which is utterly different from what's going on in the present time, which is rather, I think, sad for human beings. And that won't be easy, because we'll have to face the voices of disapproval and the voices of condemnation. But also it isn't easy inwardly, because as men and women know who have made this journey into breaking out of things and to finding a new spirit of life and a new trust and confidence, we not only have to face what's going on outwardly, but equally we have to face the very force of the conditioning that goes on inside of us. The force of conditioning which says, how can I do that? How can I trust in things? How can I have the confidence to continue this? How can I find ways and means? How can I live with this confusion, this insecurity, this uncertainty? I don't know where it will lead. And so there are, and I'm talking with a number of you over the days here, who are actually in that process. And sometimes all that one knows is that the old isn't working. All that one knows is that one doesn't really want to go back to it. One doesn't want to go back into that shell, into that enclosure, and therefore one's not only living with the disapproval of society, who are telling us what we should do and how we should live and we should get a job and be secure and career and all of that. And it takes a certain kind of spirit and a certain kind of odd sort of confidence to actually say in the movement of our life, let me go through all of this which is uncertain and insecure. Let me take the risk with my inner life as much as with my future outwardly, and see if something fresh and new which is unfamiliar to me can emerge. And the Buddha uses the word noble. The Sanskrit word was Aryan, but of course it's not a good word in this culture, so I know I've used it. And it was, anyway, another story. So this movement, this change, is to find a way to make and ennoble our existence, to give nobility to it. And that nobility in life cannot come through birth. It can't come that way. If it came through birth, then of course there would be those who have and those who are and those who aren't. It comes through men and women radically challenging, radically like the vegetable radish, you know, that means to get to the root of. Men and women who are willing to try to get to the root of the matter of existence, challenge the forces of imprisonment and see if we can break into another consciousness. And we have the potential for that. And it would be a great pity to pass through one's life, and I've heard this a number of times over the years, and men and women who have got old and have said to me with tears in their eyes, I wasted the opportunity that I had. Even though outwardly those men and women may appear very, very successful, they've got all the things of the so-called good life, but that doesn't protect the individual from the movement of consciousness within. And sometimes that movement, as I remember very visibly, one English businessman turning me to me and say, he said to me, I've got so much money that I could not possibly spend all this money that I now have, and I've wasted my existence. I blew it. And he was in tears. The man was turned 60, in tears. And so there's no ultimate comfort in what's being offered to us. It's more useful at best, it's a distraction at worst, and it's going to take, as I say, some kind of confidence and vision for us to fresh ways to look. And there are men and women who are engaged in this, who are committed to this. And sometimes that happens, of course, and it's not so much a choice for us, because I think the idea of choice anyway is just a contemporary buzzword that we get used to. Shall I have this blue shirt or red shirt, or and other irrelevances. And sometimes the force of the life brings it about for us. Sometimes it's the circumstances. For some men and women, it's simply the suffering is intolerable. But for others, even without the suffering, that one is reasonably well integrated in this world and reasonably well adjusted in this world, one has the sense for something of a different dimension. Over the years, I was talking with one person today. Over the years, I've had plenty of opportunity to have contact both east and west with junkies, people who shoot up, people who are on crack, people who are on cocaine, people who are on smack, people who are on heavy drugs, soft drugs, etc., etc. And one person that I knew and known for many years, and I have a kind of empathetic and deep sense care and love for these people, and some of you will know people perhaps in friends and families or work in those professions which have contact with such people. And one friend of mine who's had a long and painful problem with heroin, both in the east in India and in the west, and he said to me, Lirkada, telling one-line comment last year to me, he's just beginning to break out of that tense addiction, and one of the most painful that anyone can experience, to try to come through that, and using all the various things, the methadones, etc. And in a one-line statement to me, he said, for the first time there is light at the end of the tunnel, and there isn't a train coming through, an express train coming through. And sometimes in the willingness to work and to break free, sometimes even that step, like for him, is terrifying. And one of the things I notice with such people and many others, given all the manipulation and all that goes along in that rather tragic world and tragic community, for some it genuinely is a recognition of the madness of society, the destructiveness of it in people's lives and to land, water and air, and the exploitation of our world that we live in. And some sense there has to be another dimension, there has to be something other, and for some the vehicle has become the drugs to get out of the wretchedness and the horror and the obscenity of it all and to find something else, and the instrument becomes the needle, the instrument becomes the dope, the instrument becomes the hash, the instrument becomes uppers and downers, cocaine or whatever it might be. And no one may say it's sad, one might even say, well, it's wrong or whatever view, and I think incidentally treating such people as criminals I find disgusting, that it needs understanding and working with, and not the criminalization of people in such a plight. But some way, in some strange way, I think it reminds us there is a potential for another dimension, and there is the means and vehicles for that. And in the best of deep religious life, in the best of deep spirituality, and especially deep awareness for life, we can discover it. And therefore we make our life noble, and we live a noble life, because we're willing to do anything in life to realize and discover that through means which are skillful and not end up in pain and horror and addiction. And I believe that to be an extraordinary challenge to us. When that is difficult, and sometimes it's acutely difficult, of course, but when it's difficult and we lose confidence and we lose trust, and I think we can give much of trust and confidence to each other, when we lose it, one does get this feeling almost with mantra-like repetition, oh, what can you do? And the self, which is terribly small, looks at circumstances around, whatever they, those circumstances may be, and you have to look to see for yourself what that might mean for you. We look at the circumstances around, and the conclusion which is drawn in the mind is, the circumstances are so big, I am so small, therefore what can I do? And this has the impact of actually giving paralysis to meaningful life, and one slips into a meaningless life because one believes, through loss of trust, through loss of confidence, that one is so small, one is weak, one is ineffective, one can't do anything, and what is around is so big. And one believes in this paradigm, one believes in this comparing of small to so big, it kills the spirit in us. It kills the trust and the confidence. And thus we end up submitting and repeating what others do. And we can't see a way out of it. We are not small. We are not. We are men and women of the earth. This is our home, this is our place, and if we are clear and conscious as much as possible about what's going on and what the forms of imprisonment are in life, we'll never be satisfied unless we take the challenge and break through with it. Beautiful thing to do. And if we're to talk about meaning in life, then surely that exploration, which here we use the language of Dharma, not meditation here, I'm talking about use the language of Dharma, use the language of vehicles to transform a life, not only inwardly but outwardly. At the moment, you can't read, but teachers have privileges. So one of them is reading on a retreat, and it's mildly ironic because the book I'm reading is about the Antarctic. I mentioned this a few days ago. You know, it's a bit colder than here, I suspect. I've never been, but having looked at this book, I'd love to go. And so this is this man, Ernest Shackleton, who set off in 1915 with about, I think, 35 men, if I remember rightly. And I just want, there's two quotes I want to put in here to remind, to kind of this really communicates what I'm talking about in this talk. And they set off in a ship called the Endurance, which in fact didn't endure very long. And they got to the very edge of the Antarctic, and the ship completely froze in the ice, absolutely trapped in the ice. And in being trapped in the ice, it was somebody kindly bring that lamp over. So in a second. Oh, thanks, Idalia. Great. And in its being trapped in the ice, Shackleton, the leader of the expedition to get to the center of the Antarctic, had a huge issue on his hand. How could he save the life of his men, all men, and his own life? What was necessary to be done? And they knew that with the pressure from the ice, that within a short period of time the ship would crack. So what they had to do, they had three small boats, and they put the boats onto an ice floe. Stayed on the ship, I think it was about 6 weeks, if I remember rightly from the story, and got onto the ice floe. And they were on this ice floe, these men, for months, sitting on an ice floe, hundreds of miles from anywhere, and the ice floe that they were sitting on was moving all the time, 500 miles, 750 kilometers, sitting on this load, moving. And Worsley, who was the second in command, sometimes the cracks in the ice would come, and one piece of the ice float would just float off. And in rather extraordinary one of the sailors was, it broke off, and in the night he was in his sleeping bag. And they, you can imagine, months, they can't even change their clothes, etc. They're living on penguins and seals to survive. And it floated off, and Worsley looked at this person in his sleeping bag, long beard there, and he said, "My goodness, it looks like Moses in Egypt, but as an adult." And courageously, the man got into the water, and because the man was trapped in his sleeping bag, got him out and pulled him out. In. Moses would have been impressed with that. And he says here, in terms of the friendship, the support and the comradeship which took place, he says, this is 1915, "We are living," and I think it applies today, "we are living in an age which doesn't care about the spirit. It is an age which is fatally compromised by ambition and worldly success." Man sitting there, he's on an ice floe, he's hundreds of miles from anywhere, and he's writing in his diary about what we're talking about this evening. Five of the men, because as the ice floe drifted, they, with three small boats sitting on top of it, they knew at some point as it went through the winter it would have to hit the sea, and then the ice floe would break up, and if they weren't there at that moment, they never get into their boats in time, and that was it. Living with this, day in and day out. And Shackleton, seeing the terror of this situation that they were in, said he and five of the men would have to travel, row 800 miles, 1200 kilometers to a whaling station to try to get help for the remaining 28 men sitting on this ice floe. The boat that they set off in, the height of it, it says, was no higher than the bath in our bathroom. There's six men in such a small boat making this 800 mile journey across. Worsley, keeping the diary, he said, and still drifting, it was 5 months before Shackleton could get back to these men, writes, "While looking ahead," meaning the ice floe and eventually breaking up, "while looking ahead and planning to meet all possible dangers, I do not worry about these dangers, which will probably be very great, but live comfortably and happily in the present and can truly say that at present, in the present, I am enjoying myself far more than I would in civilization." You can telephone your travel agents tomorrow. So sometimes in this movement we get so used in life to seeking for security, to seeking to make life easier, to make better, to closing down and closing out and trying to keep things in a certain way. somehow in all of this we've lost something. And it wasn't as though Shackleton and the crew were being treated as heroes at that time, because it was in the middle of the First World War, and there was a common view that they were just running away. And they got permission from Winston Churchill, who was the Admiral of the Fleet, who said to them, go, proceed, do your exploration work. Some of them were scientists, do the work that you need to do. And it wasn't that when they came home there was a huge fanfare for them, because the war was still going on. So it wasn't like for ego purposes externally. And that sense sometimes of their own life, and as I say, the way we're living, confidence and trust means, for many of us, in fact, the willingness to take risks for something which will really illuminate and enliven and challenge our life, and in that have a different sense of direction. And there are some, not everybody here, but for some, I would say just listening, that's vital and important. And we need, in a way, to turn a deaf ear to all the voices which may come from our leaders and the voices of influence, etc., etc., which in some way or other keep telling us the same old thing, which closes down consciousness instead of enlivens and liberates it. And if we have doubt, and if we're having trouble with all of this and having difficulty, then just as with the plight of those men, that sometimes we need the interaction of each other, we need the support of each other, we need the reminder. And thank goodness there are men and women in this world who are willing to take those steps and risks, and we can learn a great deal from them, because they help to instill in us a sense of who we are and our real potential and our real capacity as human beings to really move things forward for the whole species. It's not a selfish thing to explore. It's not a selfish thing to do. It's something, it's like moving into what I sometimes call a kind of post-consumer culture, which has, as he says, a spirit to it. And with degrees of uncertainty which are much greater. For him, he says, happy and comfortable in the moment, yet with all the potential of what could take place in such degrees of isolation. And I think if we can just get a sense of that, of the spirit of that, and I think we need, in fact, every kind of reminder for that, then a different kind of period will come in life, and that we'll just have to see. Sometimes in this finally in this movement and this exploration, it isn't unusual that when we, for those of you who are in the retreat environment for the first time, the thoughts may be arising as you listen. I just came here for a little peace and harmony and a little calmness and a little ability to be less stressed out and a little bit more at peace with myself and my parents or my kids or whatever. No, those are fine and important and worthy values there. And in all of this, and particularly in the time of talking with you, and if I may just, with the current situation here, sometimes for some people this painful world, which has its political overtones, which you know far more intimately than I, and somebody left me a note that at a railway station some 40 minutes from here apparently there was another Hamas terrorist attack, and somebody has died and others are injured, and the repetition of this history that goes on, and then the parallel corresponding one of men, women and children dying in the occupied territories, and that brings suffering in all those directions. And some of you here, I know, and have spoken to Stephen about this, and a little to myself, and have left us notes as well, have a real concern, and a real concern of what can be done, or what can we do.
Yeah.
And I think the voices of those in that particular area are important. It is important we touch deep places of love and concern and compassion. And as the Buddha once said, when there are two warring factions fighting over land, and as somebody said in a note to me, that means resources, but fighting over that, he approached the two leaders, and his fundamental question was, is it worth shedding one drop of human blood for a piece of land? Is it worth it? Some of you here are raising questions and making decisions in these areas as this retreat is going on, and it may require from some, and I hope enough of you, to look to see what steps could be taken. What could one do to help relieve suffering, whichever direction it is in? Not one side suffering at the expense of the others, but to relieve suffering because one cares for people, and it's a sign of a noble way of living to relieve suffering. And for some, that may need to move into a more political kind of agenda, and to bring some awarenesses and depth of insight and understanding to it. And it occurred to me, and I spoke with Stephen, and he's supportive of this, is that tomorrow morning, for those of you who wish to come in the meeting room where you've been meeting with Stephen, later in the morning, probably around 11 o'clock for half an hour, perhaps some of you may come, and perhaps we can just look at things, a little bit of that together, in terms of practical steps and way that people can work, because I don't think the system, I know it isn't working, that's for sure. It's a nightmare, a terrible nightmare. And therefore, other ways, even though it's difficult. And trouble is, the old mind can easily arise and say, oh, it's all been done before. Of course, everything that's been tried has been done before. And no one would say it's anything would be totally new. But what's right and morally right for two communities, that voice is still to keep going out. And for some, that will be to say no to whatever, no to the violence, no to being a soldier and going into the occupied territories, no to giving support to killing, no to blaming either one's own government or another government. That's all the ideology of despair when we just submit. But we can look, and initiatives can come, and small steps can come for the resolution of the suffering. Small, it doesn't matter, but somehow for others. And I think it's an equally important voice, and equally to be respected, and there are plenty of you I know in the hall who feel, and many levels, and appropriately too, that this whole problem that's gone on year in and year out, of course long before the formation of Israel, as you will know well enough, that it's enough with one's life to try to live a noble way of life, to be committed to awareness and exploration in life, and to really feel, and I think it's perfectly fine, to really feel and to really say, this conflict which is going on is to do with the people who make the conflict, and that all that some of us can do with regard to that is not feed it, not bad mouth either way in either direction, not be part of it. And for some, within one's own community, within one's own society, within one's own country, all the work of relieving suffering also matters a great deal. And probably in the hall here, there are those voices both ways. Some concern which needs to go outwardly, that political way that I just spoke of, and to see what is necessary, what the trust is there, what the empowerment is necessary, what the transformation. And others will need to say, I am not supporting this conflict, I am not feeding this frenzy of mutual killing and murder that's going on in both communities, and don't want to be a part of that. And what I can do is for men and women that I know, men and women that are close to me, in giving support to their situations and to and the immediate world that we live in. And I feel both, either political or apolitical, we might say, both are completely fine. I have no trouble either way with it. But it challenges us. Either direction, we are challenged with this life. And it's going to need, as I said earlier and a few times now, that kind of spirit of not feeling depressed by situations, not feeling overwhelmed, not feeling fear, not taking any notice of those kind of old pressures and conditioning, and say, let me look afresh. Let me break out of the shell of all of that. And sometimes it's just simple determination. No psychotherapy, no years on the meditation cushion, no observation of the breath. Sometimes the voice of conviction inside just says, I'm not going to live in that old way, and that's enough, and change is coming. And sometimes that in itself does it. It just does it. One's seen the madness of living ensnared. And sometimes when one forgets, then one just goes back to our dear friend Mr. Worsley. When looking ahead and planning to meet all possible dangers, I do not worry about those dangers, which will probably be very great, but live comfortably and happy in the present, and can truly say that at present I am enjoying myself far more than I would in civilization. And I think, fantastic. To it. Never mind what comes. Let's be with it. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings live with trust and confidence. May all beings live a transformed existence. Let's have two or three quiet minutes together, please.